Today on Follow Our Lead, I talk with Meredith Buettner, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Cannabis Coalition. Having spent more than a decade developing and executing fundraising and political strategy for candidates up and down the ballot, Meredith brings a keen understanding of Pennsylvania's political landscape. She was instrumental in the passage of Act 44, the most extensive update to Pennsylvania's medical marijuana statute since its passage. Meredith has been recognized for her leadership and was presented with the 30 Under 30 Award by Politics PA. And in 2022, Metro Philly recognized her as a cannabis power player. We'll discuss how relationship building and effective communication have made her an industry leader. Well, welcome, Meredith. It's so great to have you on the Follow Our Lead podcast this morning. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
So we're just going to dive right in. Talk to us about your role as the executive director of the Pennsylvania Cannabis Coalition. What are some of your responsibilities?
Sure. So I am the executive director of Pennsylvania Cannabis Coalition. I've been here for about 3 years, and my responsibilities are everything. I'm the only employee here at the coalition, so I deal with all of the aspects of association management, but also lead our efforts in terms of government, legislative, regulatory affairs. I'm very lucky to have a team of experts that assist our association through contract work, lobbyists, attorneys, accountants. So we have, professionals where we are lacking resources.
So talk to us a little bit about your background. What industry did you come from and how did you end up in this role?
Sure. So I have a undergraduate degree in political science and a master's degree in public administration. Right out of college, I worked for a local chamber of commerce. With a focus on membership activities and event planning, sponsorships. And from that, I transitioned to working on political campaigns. And my primary role on those campaigns was fundraising, ensuring candidates had the funds they needed to win election. But I was a full-time fundraiser. A lot of my colleagues on campaigns weren't full-time. They had other obligations. They were volunteers. And because I was full-time, I ended up with a lot of responsibilities similar to my role at the coalition. I was the person who did a lot of the hiring. I was the person who dealt with the utility companies when I was trying to explain we were only going to have this office open for 6 months, dealing with landlords. And also dealing with consultants and those contractors that helped add the expertise back to what we were doing on the campaign. And then after that and doing campaign work for a while, I had my own fundraising business where I was providing the services as a contractor myself instead of as an employee. And then the opportunity with the Cannabis Coalition presented itself. And it was a great way to take all the skills I had gained during my experience and apply them to a new challenge.
Wow, you've had quite an extensive career. So you ultimately went from kind of running your own company to now running the Pennsylvania Cannabis Coalition. What made you make that switch?
Sure. So it's certainly different, but a lot of it is the same, right? A lot of it is managing relationships. A lot of it is making sure the right people are doing the right part of the job. The opportunity presented itself during the COVID-19 emergency, and my fundraising business was suffering. And because of the nature of my work, there weren't the same type of small business lifelines for my type of business as there were for more of a traditional business. My work was 1099 related. So that made things really difficult. And I had to think about what was best for me and my family. And at that time, it was just my son and I. And this opportunity presented itself as full time. It had been quite some time since I had had a traditional kind of job, but I took the leap. Also, medical cannabis is something I had been fascinated by and something I had seen really benefit so many people, particularly people in my life and in the life of others in my circle, as it related to their ability to battle addiction, and their ability to cope with things like PTSD. And I was really fascinated in how we could do better for the citizens of Pennsylvania in terms of creating access to medicine that really has demonstrated itself to be helpful to folks. So, you know, I feel like as a leader, being passionate about what you're leading on is super important. And when I worked in politics, I found that my ability to serve my clients was better when I really believed in the values and shared the values with those clients. You know, not just because you share a political party identity with a candidate doesn't mean you agree with anything they have to do, and with everything that they have to do. And I think that's something I learned along the way and along a campaign trail, that really believing in a candidate and supporting their mission is what was going to make me successful leading a team to support them. And I feel very much that way about my role now, that believing in the mission of what I'm doing is really critical to being a good leader in this space. And secondly, something that I've carried through my career is that I believe it's a leader's role to put the right people in place. No one person can do every single task. So hiring the right contractor, the right vendor, having the right person be a committee chair, is really important to a leader meeting their goals and empowering a team. So really admitting that I'm not the best person for that particular part of the job and finding the person that is something that I believe really strongly in.
When you took this role as the executive director, what opportunities did you have to forego in order to take this? Talk to us about the decision-making process that allowed you to take this role. Because I think a lot of people are in this situation where, you know, they may be getting a lot of different opportunities, especially as higher level executives. And it might be really difficult and challenging to make decisions like the one that you had to.
Yeah. And for me, I was giving up a business that I had spent 10, 11, 12 years building, a reputation that I had spent a long time building. I've raised millions and millions of dollars for candidates from everything from school board members to presidential candidates when they came in town. So for me, it was a really big decision. I was looking for a new challenge. I think when you're evaluating opportunities, you know, making a jump just for financial reasons is not always the best thing to do. I mean, in full disclosure, I had to take a step back financially to take this opportunity. But that was still the right decision because it was a challenge. There was room for growth. I felt like I was going to be empowered to build a team of people that would help me be successful. And at the end of the day, I was really excited about being able to have a direct impact on legislation and regulations in the Commonwealth. In my previous role, I was working for people who made amazing legislative changes for not only Pennsylvania, but for the country, New Jersey, wherever my clients were. But I never had a pen in my hand helping make those decisions. So it was a really unique challenge in an exciting and growing space. So I went with my gut, and my gut told me that this was a good opportunity. But I think if you're presented with multiple opportunities, I think the most important thing is to consider the one that excites you the most. And you know, not recommending throwing out great salary opportunities and benefits and those things. You certainly have to consider those. But at the same time, I think it's hugely important to love what you do every day. Being in a dead end job is not beneficial for anyone, not beneficial for you, not beneficial for your family, not beneficial for your friends, and not beneficial for the company, because you're not going to be there giving it your all. So I think really figuring out what excites you and figuring out if the company or organization is going to support you in your room for growth. For example, my board of directors is thrilled I'm doing this today, right? They want me to have opportunities and build out the presence of our organization, which can be hard as a single person running an organization. But they support me and empower me to do speaking engagements, to guest lecture, and to get out of my comfort zone. So I think, you know, being excited about an opportunity and feeling like you're going somewhere where you're going to be supported to stretch yourself and get to that next place, I think are the two most important things to consider.
In your situation in particular, you are the face of this issue in Pennsylvania for sure. And that has to come with a lot of pressure. So how are you able to manage, you know, being in such a role and having such a big responsibility when, I mean, you do have contractors, like you said, and outside experts, but ultimately it's going to fall back on you. So how are you able to kind of juggle all of that? And also you have a family.
It's not easy. I hated it at first. I really did not like being the face of the organization. I had never had to do that before. I was a fundraiser. So it was, on a political campaign, it was everybody's prerogative to keep my name out of everything, right? Like I didn't want to do that. So that was difficult. I had great media training. I worked with a professional whose their expertise was getting someone in a highly regulated industry to talk to the press, to give testimony at a hearing. And I did that media training with them. Prior to that, I had done a year-long leadership program that was aimed at politics and staying in public service. But that kind of continuing education also helped. But then also it took me a while to hit the ground running on being the public face, because as much as I knew about cannabis from personal experience and what I had read and the research I had done, it is such a unique topic. The law is very unique. The regulations are very unique. We're more highly regulated than hospitals in some senses, right? It's just, it takes a while to onboard. And one of the things I did during that time was spin the interviews or spin the public engagements to somebody else who was more experienced. But once I kind of got my sea legs under me and really learned not only how to be confident in directly answer the question, but being confident in pivoting back to what I want to be talking about. I'm really, really comfortable talking to media. I've built great relationships with folks in the media. I try not to say no, because I don't ever want to make enemies of those folks, right? So even if I say, sure, I'll talk to you. And then when I get on the phone, I'm like, look, I'm not going to say what you want me to say about this, but here's the quote that I'm willing to give. Talk again soon. That's really paid dividends. In terms of kind of being forward facing in front of the legislator or regulators, it's really knowing what's important to them. It's really knowing who your audience is and what they, not what they want to hear, but maybe what they need to hear, and framed in a way that that you're going to get through to them. For example, the medical marijuana program here in Pennsylvania is regulated by the Department of Health. So when we have meetings with the Department of Health, we need to talk about our issues in terms of what they're charged with. And what they're charged with is public health, right? So we need to make sure that when we're saying we don't want to keep video surveillance footage for 4 years, we only want to keep it for 6 months, that we're saying something like, at the end of the day, the only difference in keeping it for 6 months or 4 years is the cost in which we're passing on to patients, not the cost that's affecting our bottom line, right? The cost that's getting passed on to patients. So really figuring out how to target your messaging to your audience has been an amazing skill to master And once I was confident in it, it made the forward facing part of this role so much easier.
As a leader, we often have very difficult conversations we need to have with people, and leading with the right verbiage is always really difficult and challenging. And it sounds like you've really kind of garnered that skill from the work that you've done, especially in the training as well. So I also want to talk about how you're navigating some of these challenges surrounding cannabis use in Pennsylvania, both the medical side of it, but also just for the recreational side of it. There's a lot of misconception out there. There's a lot of misinformation. So what strategies do you use to gain support from the people who are typically opposed to the idea? We just talked about leading your messaging with understanding who your audience is, but let's dive a little bit deeper into some of the strategies you've used to gain support when people are really opposed.
I spend as much time thinking about the people that support us as the people that don't support us. And the people that don't support us are like, you know, you're insinuating that sometimes the more important people to be talking to, right? So how are we creating a message that either dissuades them from their opinion or at least gets them to agree to disagree, right? I think that's a really important skill of a leader, is to be able to walk away from a conversation agreeing to disagree on something and not trying to force your opinion on someone and you know, fighting until they come around to your viewpoint. If we can get someone to agree to disagree, we can, you know, we can walk away. I think one of the things that's been most effective for me with the legislature is making sure that I'm prepared to answer those people's questions. For example, one of the reasons we really have a hard time wrapping our heads around the legalization of cannabis for recreational use is we don't have a tool to test for driving under the influence, right? So if you got pulled over and you had been drinking alcohol, the cop would make you walk the line and then they would use the breathalyzer test. We don't have something like a breathalyzer test. And why, right? We have amazing technology. A lot of it is because of the federal illegality of cannabis and the inability of folks to do research. So instead of going into a meeting and saying, we can't do what you want us to do, we're able to say, you know, many police departments have drug recognition experts. Yes, the training is costly, but it is effective. I know folks who have been pulled over, unfortunately, for, you know, whatever reason. And because they have a medical marijuana card, the police officer said, all right, we're going to get a blood test. And advocating for yourself and asking for a drug recognition expert, you're able to demonstrate that you're not currently impaired and you are safe to operate a vehicle at that time. Being prepared with that information when you're having a conversation with somebody like that, I think is so important. Anticipating what their questions are, what their concerns are going to be. There's a legislator whose family owns a trucking company. The DUID issue is very, very important to that legislator. Being prepared with that information when you get into that room, it is very important. You know, there are legislators whose neighborhoods have been destroyed by drugs, and coming to those conversations with suggestions of solutions, not necessarily telling those folks what the answer is, but saying this is what's worked here and this is what's worked there. Let's folks form their own new opinion about something. So really leading folks to the answer, I think is one of my strategies there. Also, an example I really like to give is, you know, when someone has what you would think of as a bad idea, an unsuccessful idea, or maybe even just a completely differing opinion, instead of going in and popping their balloon, we've got to go in and deflate their balloon slowly and slowly and slowly. So that's really one of my techniques, going in and saying, you're wrong, get on my side or I'm leaving, is not the right approach in any situation, particularly when you're dealing with a highly controversial issue like cannabis.
There's probably become a point where you've kind of gone into a meeting and you've wanted the meeting to go one way and maybe it went a different way. And I'm sure you've had to make concessions and tough trade-offs as a leader and in your role in particular. How have you been able to navigate these tough trade-offs that you've inevitably had to be a part of during your role as the executive director?
I report to a executive committee made up of members. My organization is a dues-paying organization. So everybody should have a say and everybody's voice should be represented. So when we fail at something that we're trying to accomplish, I then have to go face all the people that I work for and say we failed, right? So I think one of the things that's been the most helpful and that I learned, particularly during the summer of 2021, when we were passing what's now known as Act 44 of 2021, which basically modernized the medical marijuana program. But one thing I learned during that slugfest, I guess is the best way to put it, is that my members needed to be kept in the loop. The first couple weeks, I was getting a lot of angry phone calls and I said, I have to do something to change. So what I started doing was carrying my laptop around at all times. And anytime something major happened, I sent an email. I sent an email to my membership. They weren't pretty. There probably was spelling mistakes. I have no comms department. There was nobody double checking for them. We have a shared former colleague who's a comms expert that sometimes if his days aren't crazy, he gets my frantic, read this before I press send, using my resources. But sometimes you just have to send it, right? And you just have to say, please excuse this email for any typos and get it out. Because what's most important is that you don't leave one of your stakeholders out of the conversation. And you know, I'll tell you, even in the past couple of weeks, so for those that are listening that don't know, in Pennsylvania, June is when our legislature is focused on our state budget. Constitutionally, they're supposed to pass a budget by June 30th. We're hearing it's going to be more like July-ish this year. So it's crunch time in Harrisburg. And even last week, we saw something that was cannabis related that had a lot of stakeholder input prior to the piece of legislation being run. But there were some stakeholders that folks didn't think about and their opinions hadn't been considered. And when they got in front of the legislators, things fell apart with that legislation because they hadn't built consensus and hadn't communicated, you know, that information both ways. Folks hadn't had the opportunity to communicate their concerns. And the legislature hadn't had the opportunity to communicate their goals. And unfortunately, the breakdown in communication caused a breakdown in the legislation. So, you know, really communicating, making sure your stakeholders are informed, you know, and asking for feedback from the folks that have expressed interest in the project you're working on. Sometimes it's hard to keep track of, and sometimes I'm writing on chicken scratch on my desk calendar, but you know, so-and-so and so-and-so asked me about this week. So when we are working on that in 2 weeks, I need to remember to just even shoot them a text message and tell them to read the article or tell them to call this legislator. A lot of it's people management. And a lot of that is really hard to do as one person. One thing I've spent a lot of time doing with my members when we don't have something active going on, I hold monthly calls by subject matter, and I hold a quarterly membership meeting where we go over everything for everyone. And a couple members had contacted me about very specific things in the last couple weeks. And when I put together my presentation for the next meeting, I made sure I included those because if those members have those questions, it's pretty safe to assume that other members have those questions too. So addressing it for the entire group can often save you from having to make 17 phone calls. So that's definitely something that I try and do as well. Share the information with as many people as appropriate at one time.
Being the only person, you're juggling the strategy of the organization and you're also juggling the execution of it. How are you able to juggle all of these responsibilities? Some people just, their job is just the strategy of an organization. And then there's a bunch of other people to do the execution. You're doing all of that. And that must be really hard. And I feel like at times probably very overwhelming.
One of the things certainly is hiring the right contractors to help so that it takes some of the worry away on specific things. Having really good lobbyists and consultants that understand the issue, but also understand the legislature so that I don't have to do quite as much of it. Also, knowing when I want to be in the Capitol and I want to be part of the conversations, but that's not the best use of my time is really, really difficult. I want to see that the strategy that we've spent so much time working on, that our membership has signed off on, that our membership has agreed to pay dues because this is our strategy. Not overseeing that personally can be really difficult at times. Before we logged on, I'm sitting here refreshing the Senate calendar because I'm waiting for a meeting to pop that hasn't popped yet. I have to remember when the meeting pops, my lobbyist is going to text me. That's their job, right? So some of it is just like trusting the people that work for you, but also my members expect me to be on top of it all. So I have to manage expectations of the folks that are the organization against the, you know, the abilities of the people that I've hired to help me do the job. So not easy. I try to automate as many things that I can. I have, you know, I keep our calendar public for our members so that they can access it. I've created a password protected spot on our website where members can access any public document that we create, anything I'm handing out to a legislator, my members can find that behind a password protected portion of the website, and they can find each other's contact information there. So trying to make folks self-sufficient, but that can be really difficult as well, right? They're all busy too. This isn't their, being part of the association is not their full-time job, but trying to create enough access for folks so that they can do it. But at the end of the day, also remembering that I can't do everything, right? And trying to set priorities. I like to use a to-do list. At the top of it, it has three things that must be done today. And then it has 10 other things. And then it has a note section. So I'll try to, as the day goes on, if something else comes up, I'll put that in the notes section so it can move up to, you know, the list of 10 for the following day. Also, giving myself grace to not always getting it done. I am very lucky. My board of directors is very supportive and their expertise is really different than mine. I have three board members who were attorneys. All of my board members have been in cannabis longer than I have. So I have a really good support network there. And they also have folks that work for them and support them who are supportive of me. So sometimes realizing, again, I'm not the best person for this job, but there's probably somebody in our membership who is. Additionally, I have spent time plugging myself into organizations of other association directors. I'm involved with two national associations for national cannabis associations that have regular meetings for association directors. One is really focused on federal priorities. So I meet our organization's goals of staying plugged into federal legislation through that organization. And another organization really focused on best practices in state programs and how we can help each other implement them. Sometimes the answer is using somebody else's work with their permission, but that's been really super important. Those listservs, et cetera, have been really super important to getting an answer to a really difficult question quickly.
But I feel like in the cannabis industry, you have a lot of long-term goals. How are you able to stay focused and driven when you might not see immediate results? You may win over a legislator in that moment, but it's leading to your long-term goal. And I'm sure that there are small wins along the way. But I also feel like it must be really difficult in a situation where you're not getting that big win all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Our last big win as an industry here in Pennsylvania was in the summer of 2021. That's 2 years ago. We passed a smaller piece of legislation last year that was still good. It still moved the industry forward, but it didn't necessarily provide any immediate results for our members. What we did, though, is we've been able to take that success and support a larger project that we're working on at the federal level. So banking is something we talk a lot about in cannabis because we don't have access to traditional banking. I don't want folks to think that cannabis companies are carrying around bags of cash to pay their employees because that's not the case. We've figured that kind of stuff out, but we don't have access to traditional banking in terms of traditional lending, traditional financing, all those things. We don't have access to that because cannabis is still federally illegal. So we were able to pass a piece of legislation at the state level called State Safe Banking that while it didn't necessarily give my members new access to like traditional bank accounts to run payroll out of. It gave the banks the information they needed to be comfortable banking cannabis. So it was really, really super important. But the more important piece was that we took that. We got 8 Republican state senators to sign a letter to our federal legislators saying, you guys need to do this at the federal level. If we're able to do it here, you guys need to do it there to make this better for everybody. So trying to turn small wins into bigger wins and use that work to get the small win while we're searching for the big win, I think is something that I've learned. Telling my members everything we're doing along the way to get to that bigger goal, I think has been super important as well. You know, every time I prepare a testimony for a hearing, we share that with our members, because the win there is not that we necessarily got a piece of legislation passed, but we were asked for testimony, right? So we're at the table. So demonstrating to our membership that we're part of the conversation, so that when we get to that big conversation, when we get to the legalization conversation here in Pennsylvania, that we're, you know, we're front and center at the table. So I think that's super important to demonstrate to your, you know, in my case, members, but demonstrate to your team that everything you're doing is building towards that big goal. Then looking for success along the way as well. We have a couple things we're working on right now that could end up getting done in the budget. It won't be that ultimate goal of getting adult use done, but every little thing, as long as we celebrate it and bang the pots and pans loud enough about it, it helps us move in the right direction. But I will say, when you're a membership organization and you have, you know, you have a strategy, you have a goal. So for us, it's the passage of recreational, of adult use cannabis. When you have that goal and you work with the legislature to file a piece of legislation, you work with the legislature to file a co-sponsorship memo, and then nothing happens, one of the hardest things is dealing with the blame for it not happening. And instead of taking the blame, you want to say, well, it's not my fault, it's this person's fault, they're not doing it. But that's not what your members or your board folks, that's not what they want to hear. What they want to hear is how you're moving that forward, right? So realize the bill hasn't been filed. We were hoping it would be filed by now. In the meantime, here's what we've done. Here's what we're hearing. Here's what we've anticipating. And here's what you can do to help us get to our goal. You know, pick up the phone, call your legislator, say, this is important. Not only to me, but to the 55 people I employ that live in your district, and make it personal. Ask them to be part of the solution while they're yelling at you for not getting it done, right? Here's what you can do to help me get to where we both want to be.
It sounds like you're getting feedback from a lot of different places. You're getting feedback from legislators, you're getting feedback from the board, you're getting feedback from the members, and then you're probably getting feedback from lobbyists and other contractors as well.
Don't forget the folks on Twitter. They have there a lot of opinions too. Yeah.
So how are you able to kind of weed through that and figure out how to take what's constructive? You're never going to appease everyone, which we know. But I also think it's got to be very challenging too, what is going to move the needle forward for you and help you develop as a leader.
I certainly never make a decision about something based off of one person's opinion, and particularly off of mine. I have to remember that I am the executive director of the Pennsylvania Cannabis Coalition. I may have a personal opinion about something that doesn't line up with what my members want to see done. So that bias has to go. I can say what I think and give my personal opinion, but at the end of the day, that's not my job. My job is to represent my members' opinion. Sometimes our executive committee, our board of directors, their opinion is very different than what I'm hearing from my general membership. And I have to remind my executive committee that my job is to make sure that I'm representing, you know, membership's opinion. I have a personal rule of three. If three members bring something to my attention or three members address something with me, I add it to a list of priorities that need to be addressed. We're a small organization. We have like 30-ish members, give or take. So if three people call me about something, that's 10%. So I have to, at the very least, address it with my executive committee. I never share who those three members are. I always protect my members and their opinions. I will share the makeup of their organization because we have very different types of members. So that's sometimes important to the conversation. Knowing when something is not appropriate for us as an association to address, but it might be for a smaller group of our members. And then figuring out a way that we can support them in meeting their goal without using resources that are meant for the entire association. For instance, we had an issue going on in Philadelphia recently that really, in the long run, it could affect our entire membership. But right now, it only represents our members with facilities in Philadelphia. So what we were able to do is sign a special project contract, which those members supported financially, but had the administrative resources of me to help, you know, to help work the project. So sometimes taking folks and putting them into smaller groups, it is the answer. When you're talking about hearing feedback from the legislature, that's a tough one because you're dealing with some folks who support cannabis, you're dealing with some folks who don't support cannabis, and you're also dealing with a huge group of folks who are completely uneducated about cannabis, and they only know what their DARE officer told them, you know, in 1990 in high school, that it's a gateway drug and all of those things. So they don't know. Instead of judging them for their opinion or telling them they're wrong, trying to educate them and provide resources and being responsive. There are a lot of differences of opinion about how cannabis should be legalized in Pennsylvania, and the different constituencies in the legislature have very different opinions on how things should be done. We are focused on, operational things since we are a trade association of operating members and medical marijuana producers and sellers. So we're really focused on our role in adult use cannabis policy, but being responsive about things that maybe we feel are outside of our wheelhouse, but are still being asked of us by legislators. So sometimes just acting as a resource and saying we're focused on, you know, operational success, but we have partners at the national level. We have partners all over the country who have seen adult use programs be successful. Let me compile that information for you and give it to you without bias, right? Let me just get you that information so that you can make a decision about it and we can have another conversation about it. At the end of the day, the legislature's in charge. The leadership of those legislative bodies has a lot of power. Educating them, providing them resources, sharing your opinion, directly lobbying them, asking your members to call them can only go so far. You're not always going to win. So when you don't win, what do you do? How do you regroup? How do you say, how do you look at your members and say, this isn't going to happen, guys. Let's pick something new. Without everybody saying, I'm leaving, forget it. If you can't do it, I'll go somewhere else. So that's really hard too, but that's part of the job, right? It's my job to go to the Capitol with my lobbyists and meet with those folks and then come back and figure out how to explain it to members.
Now, I don't want to jump the gun here, but it looks like recreational cannabis use is on the path to passage. Once that happens though, how do you see your role changing and what other challenges and opportunities do you think will come about?
I think it's twofold. So one, I spend a lot of time thinking about it in my role as the association administrator, right? As the person that like keeps the gears turning. And what does the next iteration of our organization itself look like? When our organization was founded, my predecessor spent a lot of time doing what I call the Chamber of Commerce function, like making sure that folks were connecting with each other. So if you were starting a cannabis business and you needed an insurance agent or an accountant, like we connected everybody. We've fallen away from that because we're actually, despite what it might look like to the general public, we're a really mature medical marijuana market. We have like 175-ish dispensaries running in Pennsylvania. We have 35 grower processors. We have nine companies that are affiliated with the state's medical schools doing medical cannabis research every day. So we're a pretty mature market. So my members don't call me and ask for a recommendation for an insurance guy anymore. That's not where we are, but it's where we're going to be, right? When we pass adult use and there's more permits, more licenses available, more opportunities for folks to build cannabis businesses, they're going to have all those same questions that folks had before. So something I've been spending the first 6 months of the year doing is building out some membership types for folks to get in the mix now, so the transition isn't so abrupt, right? So we're prepared. So maybe you're thinking about wanting a license when we get to adult use. You really want to open a dispensary. So I've been thinking about, how do I create a membership for that person that gets them in the mix, helps them start building relationships, but doesn't take away from the priorities of my permit holding members that I represent first and foremost. So it has not been an easy challenge. Also, creating value as only a single person is I'm going to have to start working, 11 hours a day instead of 10, but we'll figure it out. We'll hire somebody to help us do it. We'll make it work. So how do we get, how do we get to that next stage, get through that Chamber of Commerce phase? And I'm really lucky. I've got a lot of friends that are still in really active chambers that do great work, who I can bounce ideas off of. So, looking to move to kind of that next stage, but then our legislative priorities are going to change. I think we've seen very, very few, if not any at all, adult use cannabis rollouts that haven't required continuous legislative activity after they've been passed. You're always going to figure out that you didn't do something correctly. So I think initially it'll just be closely watching the implementation of the law. And then at the same time, the regulations will roll out after the legislation rolls out. So the legislation tells us what to do. The regulations tell us how to do it. The cost of doing business is in the regulations, not in the legislation. So we'll go back to kind of a regulatory watchdog phase for a little bit. I really hope for us that in 5 years when we're having this conversation, 6 years when we're having this conversation, that we'll talk about cannabis policy similar to the way that we talk about alcohol policy. Any given legislative session, you might see 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 pieces of legislation related to alcohol pass through the legislature. It's not a taboo topic. We're talking about the liquor industry, the beer industry on a regular basis. We've been able to foster a wonderful craft beer, craft wine community here in Pennsylvania. We have wine trails, we have beer trails. We were able to figure out ready-to-go cocktails during the COVID-19 emergency to keep small bars and restaurants in business. But we were able to do that because it was a policy that our legislature was familiar with. We had our heads wrapped around, so we're able to pivot quickly and understand how it not only impacts businesses, but how it impacts public health. Because you can't ignore that any alcohol, tobacco, cannabis have an impact on public health. So I hope that in 5 or 6 years, we've done our job and the legislature has enough knowledge that they're able to be more nimble about passing legislation. So, when I think about how we get there, it'll depend on how adult use legislation is built out. Right now, as I mentioned earlier, we're regulated by the Department of Health. If we go to Department of Commerce, it might be a very different situation. If we go to a new regulatory body, if we go to the Liquor Control Board, right? So it could be a very different kind of iteration of what we're doing and prepared based on what's happened in other states and how we react to that, I think is, all is going to play out here, hopefully shortly.
You've had some really great advice that you've peppered in throughout this conversation. I want to talk about the best piece of advice you've ever received and how that has changed the way you have led. You talked a little bit about knowing your audience and being able to lead with the right foot forward.
I don't know if I have one particular piece of advice, but I have one particular mentor who his style of doing things was to make sure that everybody understood what we were doing. It wasn't just pulling a group of interns into a room and saying, stuff envelopes. It was saying, hey guys, this is why we're doing it. These letters are going to people that care about these issues. We have data that demonstrates that. We have data that demonstrates that they vote about a particular subject. So this, what you're doing here is really important. Empowering people in the work that you're asking them to do. I think just like my monthly calls that I have with my membership, you know, giving them the tools to help create the feedback that we're giving to the legislators or the regulators, that they know it's coming directly from them, that they understand what we're doing, and that they understand why we're asking them to do it. And then also never asking anybody to do something that you aren't willing to do yourself. When we were on campaigns, that was going to knock on doors when I was asking people to go knock on 150 doors a day. I needed to go do it myself and I needed to lead by example. Now that's going to have the hard conversations that I don't want to have with legislators, but they need to be had. And I'm the face of this organization. I can't ask my members to make a phone call that's not going to be fun for them if I'm not willing to do it myself.
I think that's really great advice. And while we're on the topic of recommendations and advice, a book or a podcast or something tangible that people can read or listen to that will help them move their career forward, we would love to add your suggestions to our BGAF library or just suggestion list about podcasts and whatnot.
Right now, I spend a lot of time listening to podcasts that are cannabis industry specific. But the one that I will recommend is called Cannabis Grand Rounds, like a hospital round, like a doctor does their rounds in the morning. It is a podcast by three doctors about medical cannabis and cannabis in general. They're like 11 to 15 minute episodes. But if you have no foundation in understanding cannabis, and maybe somebody in your life uses cannabis and you haven't been supportive of that, because I think there's a lot of people who still believe in all the stigmas, this gives a really scientific medical approach. Additionally, I listen to a lot of cannabis business podcasts about how to be a successful grower, how to lead a successful team. And there are a lot of leadership lessons tucked in there, but probably not necessarily relevant for all of your folks here. I just think my biggest recommendation is to just really dive into whatever you're trying to learn about and really immerse yourself in it. I have a couple podcasts that are like kind of junky, kind of just comedy ones, like let my brain relax and let me stop thinking about work all the time. I'm at a point in my career where sometimes like books, TV, podcasts are more about disconnecting they are for me, because I do everything. My email's always buzzing. My phone is always ringing. And really trying to separate and create some kind of work like white life balance. And when you work from home, we all know it's even more difficult to separate it. But if you look at it as an opportunity to create more work life balance, I switch the laundry while I eat my lunch. I'm not going to hide that. But that lets me spend more time with my family in the evening, right? So I think that, I think that a lot of times I really have tried to separate, shut down at the end of the day, while, you know, continuing to do the stuff I love.
I know we're coming up on time, so I just wanted to thank you so much for being here and joining us and giving us all that great information about the coalition and also just about your role and your experience. So thank you, Meredith.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to do it.
Meredith left a successful business to advocate for a cause she felt passionate about. Despite not having worked in the cannabis industry before, Meredith's background in politics, advocacy, and fundraising helped advance the coalition's efforts. As a team of one, Meredith has learned the importance of staying well-informed of industry trends and changes, outsourcing when needed, and building relationships. When working with legislators, Meredith focuses on being prepared to address their concerns and educate. To learn more about the Pennsylvania Cannabis Coalition, we'll provide a link in the description notes, as well as Meredith's podcast suggestions. Until next time.